Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The Vietnam War is often called America's most controversial war. Many servicemen from Appalachia were pushed toward the front lines. More West Virginians per capita fought and died in the Vietnam War than any other state. Today, we'll hear the personal stories of five veterans who talk about the traumatic events of this war and how that's affected their lives.
And I think my experience in Vietnam changed my core value in my life, I mean, forever.
Dave Evans suffered a horrific injury in Vietnam, losing both his legs. Today, he travels to war-torn countries, treating the innocent bystanders of war.
When you think about it, these young kids, they're in the same situation I was 46 years ago. They're sitting in a wheelchair with very little hope. So I guess it's my way of paying back the world for what happened in Vietnam and what we did there.
Today, personal stories from five Appalachian Vietnam veterans. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. More than 2.5 million Americans either enlisted or were drafted and answered the call to fight in the Vietnam War. But when they returned, many say they were often rejected, called losers, even labeled murderers. Most felt alienated. PBS and Ken Burns recently produced a special series about the Vietnam War. My colleagues at West Virginia Public Broadcasting also produced a companion film and radio broadcast profiling five Vietnam veterans who carry with them traumatic memories of battle. When they returned to America after service, they were not celebrated as heroes. Decades later, these veterans still have unsettling memories they haven't shared with their friends and families. I sat down with Suzanne Higgins, the producer of Vietnam, West Virginians Remember, to talk about why she wanted to document these stories.
What came to my attention several years ago is the fact that West Virginians per capita served the most and died the most in Vietnam. And that was an amazing thing to learn. And it always just stuck with me. And when Ken Burns, PBS, decided to do this multi-part history of the war itself, I thought this is a perfect opportunity to get to know that West Virginian who either was drafted and answered the call or enlisted and volunteered to go and fight that war. So it was really our contribution, West Virginians' contribution to this war, that really intrigued me.
Let's talk a little more about how you chose to tell this story. We meet five veterans and hear their story about not only their time fighting in Vietnam, but also growing up in West Virginia. And you share national events while taking the viewer along their personal timelines, so to speak. Why did you choose to tell the story in this way?
My objective was not to tell a history of Vietnam, but it was to, you know, profile who these gentlemen were and who they are. I also thought it was very interesting that, you know, West Virginia, coming from here, we have such a tradition of military service and military respect and taking on, you know, answering the call of duty. And so what I did is I threaded a lot of the news material of the day here in West Virginia against the backdrop of what was now happening nationally and in terms of the Vietnam War, giving us enough context to understand the stories that these gentlemen were conveying to us. It shouldn't be seen as a history of the war. It should really be seen as profiles of young men, teenagers. They were all teenagers when they joined. You know, what was unique and special about them at that time of their lives, what they were thinking and hoping for their lives, and how they made it through the experience of combat, and then reflecting about that experience so many years later.
As I was watching this film, I kept thinking, you know, how much carnage there was and death and killing. But I also thought about, you know, that comes with war. To you, as you were producing this and your experience in speaking with veterans, what makes the Vietnam War different from the others?
The difference is when these servicemen came back. They were not treated as heroes, as you hear in the film. There was such animosity. There was such anger. They were shunned. It was horrific. We were so against the war that somehow we became against the soldier. And, you know, that public opinion, after the trauma of war, to come back and to be so ill-received, other than your immediate family. And these, and the gentlemen that we profiled talk about that.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. Here's veteran Mossy Wright talking about what he remembers hearing when he and his fellow soldiers returned from Vietnam.
Baby killers this, baby killers that. It was just total disrespect. Because it's not like we wanted to go to Vietnam. We fought, we died, some of us got wounded. Until this day, I don't understand it.
That was one of the voices featured in a film by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Vietnam, West Virginians Remember. I'm speaking with Suzanne Higgins, the executive producer of the documentary.
Another thing that was just so difficult is that the fact that we didn't know about PTSD, it wasn't recognized as a real condition that needed specialized treatment. And so when veterans were showing up at VA med centers, they didn't receive the treatment that they needed to receive. That trauma, not being able to deal with their emotional trauma, coupled with the public shame and anger about the war and the warrior, made that experience profoundly devastating. And, you know, when the generation before, when their fathers or grandfathers came back from World War II, they were heroes. Not so for the returning Vietnam veteran. And that's that tragedy, as we hear in the interviews and the profiles in this documentary, that's still there. I think that's the biggest takeaway for me, is the scars of war are still so fresh for so many Vietnam veterans.
And the statistics about even today veterans committing suicide is still just alarming. 20 a day, 20 veterans a day taking their own lives. It's still an issue.
Right.
Can you explain the importance of reporting and journalism on this particular war, and perhaps even the influence that reporters had on the outcry from the public that happened afterwards?
It's been referred to, the Vietnam War has been referred to as America's first televised war. There are images that came into the 6 o'clock news, into our homes and living room, that we, the likes of which we have not seen since. We don't see the devastation in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Syria, the innocence. And that was being broadcast nightly. And what Ed Rabel tells us, that at the beginning of the war, all the journalists, because there was this trust in the government, and everything that that was said was taken for the truth, for accuracy, as the whole truth and nothing but the truth. You know, journalists up until that point would take the military line. And he said in the early years of the Kennedy administration, 60, 61, 62, into LBJ, it wasn't until really the Tet Offensive in the late 60s that things started to really turn, and they couldn't, were not accepting of what the military was telling them. And he would talk about, you know, early on, they would go and they would get the briefing from the military, and they could see that that was not the way things were happening out on the battlefield. It was a time when reporters had free range. They could move relatively freely and to report these stories. And since then, the reins have been pulled in on journalists, as you know. They are embedded, but they are given boundaries.
Award-winning producer, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, Suzanne Higgins, and the executive producer of Vietnam, West Virginians Remember. Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jessica.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll listen to more from Vietnam West Virginians Remember, a new television and radio documentary by West Virginia Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, in honor of the upcoming Veterans Day holiday, we're exploring the impact the Vietnam War had here in West Virginia. Now we're going to spend the rest of the episode listening to an excerpt from a new documentary by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Vietnam, West Virginians Remember. By the way, you can watch the complete film on our website and learn more about upcoming screenings there, too, at wvpublic.org. Here's Suzanne Higgins with the story of five veterans who served in Vietnam.
Life before Vietnam, growing up in West Virginia, is easier for these veterans to talk about. Stephen Koontz grew up in Buchanan, surrounded by strip mines. He fondly remembers his classmates.
The kids, they came from all these different backgrounds. You know, up the holla, coal miner fathers, truck driver fathers. Fathers were car dealers and doctors and lawyers and small businessmen. And all these kids went to school together and had all these wonderful experiences together. And then they just scattered to the four winds.
Lou Nutter of Kaiser always tried to help out his family with a part-time job.
I delivered newspapers while I was still in high school, like I said, for 3.5 years. I had a strong family support. I loved life, didn't have no concern whatsoever.
Mossy Wright of Berkeley County grew up in a loving, disciplined home.
You know, I was just as naive, and really my focus was on, because my parents stressed so much, you know, education, you know, and so sports and maintain good grades, you know, so that was mainly where my focus was on, you know, and, you know, also the little girls and things like that too. So, it was just all part of growing up.
Dave Evans of Cabin Creek helped his single mom care for his four younger brothers, and he played ball.
You know, I played baseball, played football, and played basketball in the summer. I was on the court from daylight till dark during the summertime and swam in the Kanawha River. I was preparing myself for the Mekong, so it's a joke. So.
Paul Casto enjoyed his childhood growing up on the family farm in Nicholas County.
My job before I went to school was feeding the pigs, slopping the hogs. And I would go out and the stuff smelled so good because there was a sweet substance that they added to it that had molasses in it, and it smelled good. And the pigs loved it. And they knew when I was coming, so they would all start winking and running along the fence. And that was great. I hunted from the time I was 8 years old. It was a good life.
These small-town boys came of age in a much more conservative era. West Virginia was fiercely patriotic, had always exalted the military, and trusted government, as heard in TV news stories of the day.
What did you learn about patriotism today?
I learned that we can go to schools without fighting, or we can go to stores, and we can be proud to be an American.
We can go to any church we want, and we can just have a free place, and those men over there, they're fighting for us so we can have a free country. And
I love my country, and the country always loves everybody in the world.
But the 1960s would prove to be a decade of both hope and heartbreak. The Civil Rights Movement, the War on Poverty, assassinations, spaceflight, and Vietnam. It began with John F. Kennedy in the White House, a young president who was fond of West Virginia because of its support of the Catholic candidate in the primary. Kennedy became determined to win the global struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, an ideological struggle between capitalism and communism. Author and historian Dr. John Hennen, Emeritus Professor of History at Morehead State University.
This was a time when people still believed what the government told them. And when Kennedy went into office, there was a lot of residual feeling, good feeling about Kennedy, even as he began to commit advisors and small contingents of ground forces into Vietnam. There was very little questioning of what was going on in Vietnam then.
Backed by the Soviet Union, the North Vietnamese government and the Viet Cong were fighting to reunify Vietnam. The Vietnamese viewed the conflict as a colonial war, a continuation of the First Indochina War against forces from France and now the United States. By 1962, President Kennedy had been told by top congressional Democratic leaders that the $2 billion American dollars already spent in defense of South Vietnam had been wasted. After the president's assassination a year later, Vice President Lyndon Johnson inherited Kennedy's Vietnam policy, declaring he would uphold the national pledge to help South Vietnam defend its independence. Dave Evans.
You know, I grew up with John Wayne movies and listening to Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, say that we'll fight any cost, pay any price, you know, to maintain freedom. And I bought the whole domino theory. I was a kid and I bought that.
Paul Casto.
Everybody talked about that. Well, if Vietnam is communist, then all of Indonesia will go communist, you know. And I thought, wow.
Then the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964. North Vietnamese PT boats allegedly fired torpedoes twice at a destroyer in international waters off the coast of North Vietnam. Congress responded by passing the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, effectively allowing President Johnson to wage an all-out war against North Vietnam without ever securing a formal declaration of war. U.S. troop levels approached 200,000 within a year. It wasn't long before John McNaughton, an advisor to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, criticized the escalation. Historian John Hennen.
And he was telling the Johnson administration, and he was telling the State Department, we're really only fighting in Vietnam for our national credibility now. We have to prove to our allies that we'll stand firm when we take a stand on something. And he wasn't saying that proudly, he was saying it critically. That was in 1965.
While the anti-war movement was taking hold in some larger cities across the country, here, West Virginia remained largely supportive of U.S. Vietnam policy. Wheeling College students, eligible for deferments, sounded off on the first public burning of draft cards.
I am against these demonstrations. I think our policy in Vietnam should continue as it is. I don't see where pulling our troops out of Vietnam is going to offer any solution. And these riots at this particular time during the crisis in Vietnam is not helping our morale over there. And I guess it's detrimental to the men who are doing their duty there.
Medal of Honor recipient Woody Williams and Democratic Congressman Ken Heckler joined veterans who hiked from Charleston to Huntington in support of U.S. policy in Vietnam. There, Marshall University Dean John Shea was interviewed about a campus-wide student survey.
Most of the Marshall students to date don't speak out on this, although certainly they registered their support of the administration's Vietnam policy in the vote which was taken last week.
At the end of 1965, Republican Congressman Arch Moore had just returned from a fact-finding trip to Vietnam, where his helicopter was fired upon by Viet Cong.
You now fully support administration policy in Vietnam.
Well, when you say, do I now support, I've always supported the question of the problems in Vietnam and the administration's position. And I have only been critical of it to the extent that I felt that if we had a purpose and we were committed and the decision had been made, we had to use our best effort possible. And I think we're doing that now.
Again, historian John Hennen.
It was not unusual for young Appalachian soldiers, rural Appalachians particularly, and in West Virginia, to look to the military partly as an obligation, partly as a family tradition, partly as a way to do what they saw as their duty as a citizen, and partly for excitement. Poor, a minority young people, for the most part, who see the military as the way of opportunity.
Stephen Kuntz.
I grew up in Buckhannon, listening to my dad and his friends sit on the porch and talk about their experiences during World War II. And they'd been all over. They'd been in the Navy, the Army, you know, the Army Air Corps, a few Marines, and they all had stories to tell. And the stories weren't about blood and guts. It was all the adventures they had, you know, seeing Paris for the first time or going to sea on a stormy night. So I signed up when I was 19, became a naval aviator.
Paul Casto.
I played football and I wrestled. And I got hurt my senior year, so college was kind of out. And so I watched a movie with a couple friends of mine, The Sands of Iwo Jima with John Wayne. And Vietnam was happening. I'd already lost friends there that I knew. And so we watched this movie and we said, let's join the Marine Corps. And we did.
Lou Nutter.
I got a letter from the service stating that I'm being drafted. And I accepted that because my community accepted that you served. My family accepted that you serve. It's honor. It's my time. I'm going to go.
Dave Evans.
If I knew if I was going to war, I wanted to be trained, and I felt at the time the Marine Corps had the best training available, so I wound up in Parris Island, South Carolina. If you've ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket, it'll give you some idea of what it was like, and I did that as a 17-year-old.
Mossy Wright.
My plans was to go to college, but 3 months after graduation, I got that letter from Uncle Sam in the mail. During that period of time, the riots and things of that nature, you know. It was kind of confusing for me, you know, because I really didn't understand the whole politics of things, you know, why certain things happen to good people.
That confusion was no doubt in part fed by the graphic images that were being seen on television, the Civil Rights Movement and Vietnam, America's first televised war. Ed Rabel, former CBS News correspondent.
So it was, for me, obviously a huge learning experience coming from the mountains and the hills of West Virginia and going off and seeing this war. I saw what they were going through and I witnessed it personally, and television news had tremendous impact.
Historian John Hennen.
When Vietnam began to heat up, rural West Virginia guys and some women as well who went into nursing and that type of thing were pretty much a ready pool for recruiters. The military actually tracked rural guys, young rural guys, to do things like walk point in the jungle because they had experience tracking, they had experience hunting, they were comfortable with weapons and these sort of things. And West Virginians and other rural Appalachians were pretty highly valued as combat soldiers.
Stephen Kuntz.
Mom was kept a brave face on it. First place, she didn't think I was had the physical capability to learn how to fly a jet airplane. So that worried her. And I think she secretly decided that I'd probably, you know, get washed out of the program. And I remember one comment, he can't even walk across a basketball court without tripping over the painted lines. And at some point you say, I'll just trust in God that he'll take care of him and he'll come home all in one piece.
Paul Casto.
I remember going for induction. The Marine Corps didn't make its quota. And so the first sergeant from the Marine Corps called over to the first sergeant from the Army and said, hey, you got a few good men, Top. And I remember all those guys were in that line were terrified because You knew if you went to the Marine Corps in 2 years, you were going to go to Vietnam. There was no question. You were a fodder.
Mossy Wright.
When we got off the bus, all the screaming in your face, talking and about the drill instructors, and, you know, you got your bags, you had to go get your hair shaved. That experience there kind of really had me shook up.
Vietnam saw the unleashing of the United States' massive air power. The assignment for combat soldiers on the ground at the front was to expose themselves, draw enemy fire, and in the process expose the enemy. Officers would then have radio operators call in for air support. Historian John Hennen.
Why was the per capita death rate for West Virginia soldiers so high? My speculation would be because so many of them were put into the most critically dangerous situations, such as they called it, walking point.
U.S. Marine Paul Casto was a forward observer assigned to protection of Da Nang Air Base.
I was 18 years old, walking along a road. I had an M16, round in the chamber, grenades on my belt. You know, as an 18-year-old, that was pretty wondrous, you know. I felt like I could, I was impervious.
Dave Evans was also a U.S. Marine, infantry, also 18 when deployed.
In Vietnam, when I got there, I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division that was in the Quezon Mountains, near the border of Laos and the DMC. We were in a rough place. The Marine Corps had about one quarter of the troops in Vietnam, and we suffered about 45% of the casualties there. So we were in really rough places.
Lou Nutter was stationed with the U.S. Army's 554 Combat Engineers.
Our main job at that time was to build a road from Dalat all the way down to Long Bend called Highway 1. I finished that job. The unit stood down, and I ended up going down to the Mekong Delta with Engineer Command.
Mossy Wright was U.S. Army Infantry.
I was with Charlie Company. Us in the forward areas, we really truly had a bond, and you didn't have to deal with the racism and things of that nature, because you didn't have time for that.
Stephen Koontz completed Officer Candidate School and Flight School after graduating from West Virginia University and served as a naval aviator.
Our first cruise on Enterprise was during the bombing halt of North Vietnam. So we did close air support in South Vietnam, and we bombed in Laos. And so the second cruise, we went up north.
All of these West Virginia Vietnam vets served their tours between the late 1960s and 1972, during the bloodiest years of Vietnam and the height of anti-war protests. Dave Evans.
When I was 18 years old, I was a squad leader in the United States Marine Corps. I could bring an F-14 Phantom in and drop napalm on a village with no other authorization but mine. No pilot ever asked me, "How old are you, kid?" I would just say, "Give me high explosive, and I need it right now." And they would do it. That's the way that war was ran. That's the way the war was ran.
Paul Casto.
They sent in all these new guys. They wanted to see if they could mobilize a regiment from the United States and get them there within so much time and have them in the field. They did. And they got totally whacked. It was a massacre.
Stephen Koontz.
Wherever you went into the locker room to suit up, you know, you took your wallet out, you took your wedding ring off and put it there, and you realize you could get shot down. If you lived through it, you might be a POW in Hanoi and tortured or whatever. But you looked at each other and you say, if this other guy can do it, I can do it.
Mossy Wright.
Bullets, splitting trees, the explosions from mortars, from rockets. the shrapnel, you know, the death, you know, because, you know, you can't hear really, you can't hear nothing. It was just tough for me.
Lou Nutter.
There was a couple incidents that I can remember, and I don't like to talk about them. That's, to me, it's a little bit more personal with me and my social worker and psychiatrist. I don't even talk too much about it with my wife.
News reporter Ed Rabel.
One of the things that was dispiriting for me and angered me as a reporter was going to what we called the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon to hear the military tell us their version of what was happening in Vietnam and what we knew by visiting the battlefield ourselves about what was happening. And those were two totally different stories. One, body count equated victory, and the more bodies we could count, why, the greater the victory. But that didn't necessarily mean that we were winning the war.
Most combat Marines and soldiers have harrowing memories of their very first days of engagement. Dave Evans of Cabin Creek.
My first day in the field, coming off the helicopter, we made contact and was taking fire from a village, and we leveled the village. I mean, we really did. It was my first 5 minutes off the helicopter, and I kept thinking to myself, I've got 364 more days of this, you know. Once we recovered the bodies, we had 3 dead North Vietnamese soldiers, 2 older ladies, and 2 babies. 4 or 5-year-old children were dead. And I remember coming over. I was a radio operator at the time. I was carrying a radio for my lieutenant and looking at these bodies and saying, okay, we killed them to liberate them. And I kept thinking, there's something fundamentally wrong here. You know, we weren't taught in Paris Island to shoot children and old women. But suddenly that was the norm. You know, could we have done something different? We were taking fire. I don't think so. Should we have been there in the first place? Hell no.
Mossy Wright of Bunker Hill.
We went out on a search and destroy by the foliage in the jungle. So you can't see nobody. So the muzzle flashes, you just fire back. My first time seeing and smelling dead bodies, I threw up. And they were Viet Cong soldiers that we killed. And it's something that has stayed with me.
Stephen Kuntz of Buchanan.
My roommate got shot down, so you know I had to pack all his stuff up, write a letter to his wife and all that stuff, and it could have been me. I think everybody in combat has to come to that conclusion sooner or later, that you know, you're going to do the best you can. If you live through it, fine. If you don't, it's up to the man upstairs. Play the cards as they're dealt.
Again, Dave Evans.
You know, there was an old saying, better you than me. And it ain't nothing but a thing. I mean, that's all you could do when somebody died. You know, it ain't nothing but a thing, or better him than me. And that separates you from the pain. That separates you. You know, if you go into mourning, you're never going to come out of it. You're never going to come out of it. You try to rationalize that death as something that was inevitable, and it was better this guy died than you. It's horrible. It's a mess.
Paul Castro remains tortured with memories of his first combat experience. January 1968, the Vietnamese New Year's, and the beginning of months of Viet Cong uprisings throughout South Vietnam, known as the Tet Offensive.
All of a sudden, everything lit up all around us. Da Nang, explosions. I was standing on the outside looking at all this, and all of a sudden these green things started hitting all around me. And, you know, wondrously, It was like I was in a bunch of fireflies, and it was bullets, and we destroyed the village. I remember this young black man, he got shot in the head, and the bullet had just went underneath the skin of his temple, and he was bleeding. We couldn't stop the bleeding, and I remember I was calling for an evac, and nobody could come in because we were getting so much fire. And I remember him yelling for his mom for probably 10 minutes. And that was my first day. And when I got done there, I felt like an old man. Everything had changed. I didn't think about the things I thought about before. It was awful. It was carnage. You couldn't imagine the carnage.
This was not their natural behavior.
Dr. John Hennen, Emeritus Professor of History, Morehead State University.
This was not what they were raised to do, but they were expected to do it. And in the crisis and the madness of being under fire or maybe seeing their friends killed, they did a lot of things that they would not normally have done. But they were the ones that were seen doing it by people watching Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley back home. It wasn't Robert McNamara that was seen doing these kind of brutal things.
All right, what's wrong then? All right, give me some cover. Okay, we're trying to bring you back here. Remember to stop the bleeding.
It was these young guys like the people you're talking to now, who are now in their 60s and maybe 70s. And they were the ones that a lot of folks back home stupidly ended up directing their criticism toward.
News coverage of the Tet Offensive and news reports that followed would forever turn the U.S. as a whole against involvement in Vietnam. CBS News reporter Ed Rabel.
I remember specifically a case in which I covered a MASH unit, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital MASH unit in Quang Tri, where we recorded a young man being brought in by helicopter who had lost his arm from an explosion on the battlefield, and his legs were mangled. And this was such a dramatic story in which we saw young women, nurses, trying to save his life and him begging on camera. Now, that story appeared on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, and obviously it had tremendous impact.
Mid-1968, President Johnson announced he would not seek re-election, and the peace movement captured the spotlight. Back home, West Virginia high schoolers, including young men soon eligible for the draft, no longer saw the cause as honorable or the fight as winnable.
I'm totally against it. I don't think we should be fighting because there's too many men getting killed, and we're not going to really accomplish anything. I mean, the communists are just too much for us, really, I think.
Really, I think we should pull out because there's too many of our own men who really have families and everything back here. We belong in our own place.
While opposition only grew back home, U.S. troops carried on, trying to fit in, trying to survive. They fought fear, many turning to drugs and alcohol. They fought sinking morale because of military strategies that didn't make sense. And they fought a brutal enemy in harsh, unforgiving terrain, riddled with booby traps and hidden tunnels. They were victims of, and some participated in, atrocities.
I witnessed things that makes you want to ask, is there a God?
Some things that were done by the enemy violated a lot of my principles, And a lot of things some of us did, United States soldiers did to them. You know, it was the same thing.
Our corporal, he had a jar full of eyeballs. And he was going to take them home.
Two guys from my squad, like, mutilated a Vietnamese body by cutting their ears off and stringing them up. I didn't understand that.
I remember going through and I was taking IDs off these North Vietnamese soldiers. We were picking up stuff for intelligence, and one of them was alive. And when I went to pull the stuff, he moaned, and his insides were hanging out. And Corman came over and helped me. We put everything back in this guy, and he was still alive. And I remember these Vietnamese soldiers came over, and they had came to the village, South Vietnamese soldiers, and I was talking to the corpsman, and they started kicking him, and they were trying to tear the bandage off.
Of the soldier that you had just helped?
Yeah, this North Vietnamese soldier. And I remember I said, stop, or I'm going to kill you. I'll shoot you.
Did you ever question the mission,
the missions were junk. Johnson and his brain trust, I use that facetiously, they were worried about China coming into the North Vietnamese War, and they didn't want it to end up like Korea. So, you know, the military air bases in North Vietnam were off limits. The targets were put off limits, and he occasionally would announce that he was going to allow us to bomb something to send a political message to the North Vietnamese. And the military is being mismanaged, our military.
Did your morale suffer?
Yeah, because I was losing everything that I thought we was working for. I thought we was fighting for democracy, against communism, and things like that. So the government fed us wrong information.
I got wounded on a Saturday afternoon with a bright, clear blue sky. We were going to retrieve bodies of two helicopter pilots who had been shot down, and we were moving along a paddy dike, a rice paddy dike, and there was an ambush. They had buried an RPG, what today you would call IED, in the ground, and they command detonated that when we were near it. And then they opened up with small arms fire. You know, we fought back. We lost everybody, but the corpsman and me are the only two survivors from the nine-man squad. So we lost seven people dead right away within about 14 seconds. You know, I can still, everything's moving in slow motion. I'm firing, my weapon is blown out of my hand. I'm firing my sidearm. And I can remember thinking I'm running out of ammunition, not realizing my leg was laying 20 feet in front of me.
Dave Evans was carried out by fellow Marines who assured him he would be okay. He was wrapped in a poncho, bleeding, and put on a helicopter. Both of his legs were gone. He was 18.
You know, total chaos. That's what it was about. That's what it was. Ain't nothing but a thing.
We as students and patriots are not saying to our troops in Vietnam, we are not supporting you. That is not our intent. We are questioning why you are there.
Anti-war demonstrations escalated with Richard Nixon in the White House. A day known as the National Moratorium to End the War in Vietnam took place on October 15, 1969. That day in West Virginia, teach-ins on college campuses, but a mix of passion and apathy on the streets.
Well, really, I haven't given it much thought, but I think the people ought to just let the government take care of it.
I plan to join the march.
Particular reason?
Because I feel that people have to demonstrate just with their presence that they are concerned about this war, and it has to stop.
I certainly don't plan on marching.
Well, at Charleston Catholic, the student body is having a Mass for Peace at 1:45 in the afternoon, and my own students in their religion class are having some sort of celebration in honor of, hopefully, peace.
Later that evening in Charleston, a nighttime vigil, a few arrests, and Vietnam veterans speaking out.
What are we doing in Vietnam? We're in Vietnam having young men killed, and we're in Vietnam spending over $30 billion a year, supposedly to make the world safe for democracy. Why in the hell does the United States always have to intercede for every country on the face of the earth when the black man and the poor white man in this country is screaming for food?
The following spring, the Kent State Massacre, unarmed students were protesting the war and the recent invasion of Cambodia. Four students were killed and nine injured, shot by Ohio National Guardsmen. Campuses across the country erupted. While Marshall University's protests remained calm, West Virginia University's third day of demonstrations that May 1970 climaxed with police arriving on campus with gas masks and large sticks. With a few students perched in trees and others leaning over balconies, police used tear gas to clear University Avenue. It was during this period that these West Virginia Vietnam veterans started returning home to deal with their nightmares and with a public that often misjudged and misunderstood. Historian John Hennen.
These folks were often blamed by traditional veterans organizations for not just winning the war, you know. Why didn't you just win, you know? They were often criticized by people in the anti-war movement because they had been in Vietnam. Now, that wasn't true across the board. There was a lot of interplay. There was a lot of mutual understanding between anti-war activists and Vietnam vets. But there was a lot of just knee-jerk reaction as well.
Journalist Ed Rabel.
They survived this horror because they were able to be medevaced from the battlefield, and their wounds were bound up, but they were not able to bind up the wounds in their minds. And so that was, I think, one of the most brutal aspects of the Vietnam War.
While the U.S. pulled out of Vietnam in 1973, Vietnam vet counseling centers weren't funded until the end of the decade, and VA med centers were highly criticized for simply over-medicating traumatized veterans. In fact, post-traumatic stress disorder was not recognized as a real condition that required specialized treatment until the early 1980s. At the same time, Vietnam veterans were often stereotyped as crazed killers. While these veterans say they were for the most part respected back in West Virginia, both Paul Casto and Mossy Wright were confronted in major airports by angry war protesters.
Baby killers this, baby killers that. It was just total disrespect. Because it's not like we wanted to go to Vietnam. We fought, we died, some of us got wounded. Until this day, I don't understand it.
For the five men who have shared with us, their experience in Vietnam, most as teenagers, defined the course for the rest of their lives and the lives of their loved ones, each uniquely, each profoundly. Despite the lack of honor, understanding, and care that Vietnam veterans earned but did not receive, each of these men, in his own way, is living a life today of perseverance that inspires and demands admiration.
I struggle every day to get up.
Lou Nutter spent decades working for Alcoa and ignoring what his family saw clearly.
My problems was with my drinking and my anger. And I didn't realize I had that problem until one day my daughter said, "Dad, you got to go to the VA. You got a problem." And I think that's a lot of vets don't want to remember. But they fight it out, argue it out.
Lou says the VA's PTSD program has changed his life and that it will be part of his life forever.
One of the vets up there knew that I was struggling. And he said, Lou, you need a pet. So I talked with my wife because she wasn't too crazy about dogs. And I got a little Pekingese down there. And I wouldn't trade him for anything in this world because of the support that he gives me and the love. I'm trying to enjoy life. We make more trips. We go out together more than what we ever did. So that's a good thing.
It took a year in hospitals for Dave Evans to recover from his injuries in Vietnam. He was fitted with prosthetic legs above the knees and says he came home to a family and community that were very welcoming. He immediately joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War, at the same time going to school for prosthetic design and fitting. He became a national board member of the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation and West Virginia's first state president of the State Council of Vietnam Veterans of America.
So I think everything we've talked about in my experiences in Vietnam is relevant to what's going on in the wars that we're in today. When I see these kids and know what a waste it is or what a useless effort this has been, regime change, you know, I think, why in the hell did our sacrifices mean nothing? Everybody knew what these wars would turn out to be. I mean, it wasn't a surprise to anybody. They forgot the lessons of Vietnam.
For the last 30 years, Evans has traveled to war-torn areas, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, throughout Africa, and Central and South America. Funded by the U.S. State Department and the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, fitting the innocent bystanders of war with new limbs.
And I think my experience in Vietnam changed my core value in my life. I mean, forever. You can't talk me out of helping these folks. When you think about it, these young kids, they're in the same situation I was 46 years ago. They're sitting in a wheelchair with very little hope and part of their anatomy missing. So I guess it's my way of paying back the world for what happened in Vietnam and what we did there. It set my moral compass on due north, and I've tried to stay that route for the last 46 years.
Again, that was veteran Dave Evans, one of five West Virginians featured in a documentary by West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Vietnam, West Virginians Remember. We've been listening to an excerpt from the film. The film has three screenings scheduled across West Virginia, in Wheeling on November 10th, in Moundsville on November 11th, and in Buchanan on November 16th. All are free and open to the public. You can find more information about locations and showtimes, or you can watch the full documentary online on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Kirk Salopek, Ben Townsend, and Matt Jackford. Roxy Todd and I produce Inside Appalachia. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. You can find us online at Twitter at InAppalachia. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.